Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, authors Logan Steiner and Elizabeth Blackwell discuss writing historical fiction and Steiner's debut novel, After Anne, a novel of Lucy Maud Montgomery's life. The following conversation originally took place July 9th, 2023, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
Thank you all for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. We're here today to talk about fictionalizing the past, about writing real and imagined people in real and imagined history. In Logan Steiner's After Anne, that means following Lucy Montgomery, Maud Montgomery, as she chooses between a life as a single writer or the wife of a man mad with religious fervor. In Elizabeth Blackwell's Red Mistress, that means following an aristocratic Russian woman through revolution, early Soviet conspiracies, and forbidden love. Logan is a lawyer and writer, and After Anne is her first novel. Elizabeth's other work includes the books While Beauty Slept and On a Cold, Dark Sea. Please join me in welcoming them both.
Hello, everybody. Thank you all for coming. I told Logan I'm very old school. I have index cards I will be consulting here and there. This event is titled The Truth About Historical Fiction, and I thought that was just way too much pressure. I don't think the two of us are qualified to tell you the entire truth about historical fiction. So I decided to subtitle it The Truth About Writing Historical Fiction, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. So starting off with why historical fiction? Why is that the genre that we have both chosen to write in? And there are various approaches that writers take. Some writers want to write about a specific historical event and use the novel process as a way to explore that event. So my most recent book, Red Mistress, literally came from me thinking to myself, how did the Russian Revolution happen? I was a history major in college, but I had never actually studied Russian history in depth. When I realized how much the world changed in Russia within just a couple of years, completely. I just kind of went down this research rabbit hole to kind of find out more. And through researching, I came up with a storyline. Other historical fiction writers find a person in history that they are fascinated with. They want to find out more. The more they learn about that person, the more it makes them want to write a story exploring maybe what we don't know about that person. So I wanted to start by asking Logan, why Lucy Maud Montgomery? Why was she the person that you felt like you had to write about?
Yes, it's such a big question. And I, for me, it really was person focused. And I have to start with Anne of Green Gables, because Anne of Green Gables was such a cherished part of my growing up. And I really credit Anne and her character for my dreams of writing books someday, and not just the dream of writing a book, but believing, that me as a little girl, that I could persist and do it. And I think that, when we think about Anne and why she's stayed with so many of us for so long, and I loved learning the history of this museum, which is so much about those writers and those characters that have that staying power. And really, there's such an interesting question in why. And I can only answer for myself, but for me, Anne has had such staying power because of just her unfiltered, exuberant ways of being in the world, and how she wasn't afraid to put her feelings, her deepest feelings and thoughts out there. And I think that that's a key piece of who she is. And I am somebody who, like Anne and like Ellen Montgomery, wanted to write from a young age. And I've also always been deeply terrified of putting my work out there in the world, as I'm doing right now. And I think one of the things that has made me feel the least alone in that is learning about other creators and their lives. And so when I went to write my first book, I was really interested in exploring the life of a creator whose work had meant a lot to me, and really understanding kind of the hows and whys. That's the best way I've found to feel less alone. And I learned a little bit about the life of Ellen Montgomery, and I really felt like I wanted to know more immediately. I think, just in unpacking it a little bit, I realized how much Ellen Montgomery is like Anne and sought to be like Anne and had that deep feeling nature. And all that she was up against in her time and place in history in being that person in the world and kind of all of the real struggles with being fully herself in the world. And she really faced that bind. And that's a big part of what the book explores. And I think that that is about Maud's time and place, but I also think it's about our time and place right now. You know, I found, for me, it's a question that comes up so often. You know, every time I sit down with a friend for dinner, every time I meet a new author friend, every time I go on social media and decide what to post, and then in, you know, preparing here today to speak to all of you, it's, you know, how genuine am I going to be, and how much of myself and my deeply feeling self, a way in which I relate so much to Maud and so much to Anne, am I going to bring? And am I going to be? And I think that's such a central question in terms of the way we are in the world and how we live. And it's something that I sought to explore in this book.
So one of the great resources for you was the fact that Ellen Montgomery kept these diaries.
Yes.
And rewrote these diaries over time with the goal of them being published eventually, right? So she created a version of her life for public consumption, writing quite honestly. Yes. So in one sense, the story of her life has been out there for a long, long time in her own words. However, what I loved about this book, you clearly took these diaries, you know, quotes from the diaries are in there, obviously, but also showed how much those diaries were in a way a work of fiction also. She took truths about her life, but the way she chose to describe certain things was for a reason. She did not describe certain other pivotal moments of her life. Why didn't she write about those? So as you were reading her diaries, was that part of your inspiration too? Was the parts that were left out was where your imagination could come in?
Absolutely. And that's really where I felt like fiction had a place here. Those diaries were such a tremendous resource. So they were published not only after her death, but she left the decision about when to publish them to her son. And he ended up deciding to publish them after he passed. A really fascinating kind of undertaking. She started editing them in middle life. They're on the one hand, like Elizabeth said, so open. On the other hand, there are pieces that are missing. And they were such a resource for me as a fiction writer and trying to get as close to Maud's thinking and inside her head as much as possible. And so they were the place I started and the place that I ended in all of my research. They also had gaps. So one of the biggest was the last few years of her life are largely absent from these journals. And Maud was somebody who really tried to not, you know, to tell this story. And there's this mystery, this question left open by her biography, you know, a very comprehensive biography that's been written of her life, of what happened to this final journal. It's, you know, there was a note by her bed when she passed indicating that there was a final journal. Was it, you know, destroyed by her? Was it destroyed by somebody else? Was it taken? That was such an interesting mystery to me and a place where my imagination really took off. And that question of what drove this beloved author to such a heartbreaking end, the fact that the last 3 years of her life were missing was just a driving force of the novel for me. Yeah. As well as so many other gaps, as you were saying. And her biographers talk about how she razored out pages. She, you know, left out certain people or certain people that we know are really important to her because of what others in her life have said, only get kind of scant mention in the book. And so those were also just fascinating to me.
Yeah. And another element of the book that I loved as a writer, because you were a writer writing about a writer who was writing many levels. At various points, Lucy is going about her day, and she hears Anne's voice, the voice of her character, which is a very distinctive voice. And I think that's part of why Anne of Green Gables, that series, is still as popular as it is, because yes. Anne is such a very distinct character. So you have Lucy hearing Anne, you know, as if she is a real person speaking in a very distinct voice and giving mostly courage to, you know, oh, Anne would do this, Anne would do that. So as you were writing this book, and since you had really immersed yourself in the diaries as well, were you hearing your character speak to you? Did you have those moments?
Absolutely. You're like, what's what? For better.
Something's
for
happening in the real world, but all this stuff is happening in my head that's so much more interesting.
Yes. And it took, you know, a little while to immerse myself to the point where I got there, but absolutely. I think that's one of the reasons that those scenes where Anne is in Maud's head were one of the easiest for me to write and one of the most enjoyable. I got to them late. And I think that part of that is because I had learned what it's like to have a character speaking, you know, speaking at you. And not only during the writing process, but it's been an 8-year journey to get to this point of publication, not all of which was writing, a lot of it was you know, all the other steps along the way. But her voice has not left my head. So it's very much with me. And I'm thankful that I chose this woman to write about, because there's just a wealth of interest and wisdom from her that I keep feeling like I'm learning the next lesson that I need in my life each step of the way with this book.
Yeah, which is good. You touched a little on process. I love to talk a little bit about process, because I think one thing, if you are not a historical fiction writer, you theoretically know that it might take a long time to write a book. And yeah, some people spend years on a book. There are people who put out a book a year, which is amazing. But you know, most writers, it'll take maybe a year or two to write a book. Many writers think about an idea for years and years and years, maybe write a little bit here, a little bit there. They stop and start. So can you tell me a little bit about how long the process was? What were the various stages to getting to an actual published book, which is here on the table?
Yes, many, many stages. And I was practicing, I am a practicing lawyer and was practicing during all of the writing of this book. So that presented its own challenges, and it was helpful in its own ways too. But that was a key piece of it. Honestly, a lot of this book was written in 20-minute increments every day. So a key when I, you know, after years of having this dream, but not doing it, when I actually sat down to do it, the most helpful thing to me was to set a daily time minimum. And a lot of times I was working, you know, a 70 plus hour a week job. And so that would be kind of the last thing that I would do in the day often. Not my ideal time to write. I found out I'm such a morning writer. I'm the least self-critical in the morning, but I would do it when I could, which was at the end. Okay. And I really think it's a testament to the power of habit and making it an everyday practice. And I will not say that I have, you know, mastered that habit, because I've very much gone out of it for years since, and at certain times, and then gotten back into it. But a lot of it was written in short increments. And then so much of the process was editing. And then it was years to finding an agent, which I really felt like was a key for this book in particular, and then to have it traditionally published, and then to finding a publisher was its own journey. And then even after getting a publisher, I think it's been about 2 years from that initial signing with the publisher to the book coming out. So multi-stage process. And I think, you know, another thing about process that I'll say, I initially thought of writing as a pretty solitary act, and I thought that I would be going it alone. And, you know, I think that that's in many ways the way that Maud approached writing, the way that many of us do. And one of the biggest things that I've come to realize is how big of a role other people can play in the process, and particularly those really like key, deep, heartfelt supporters, and to learn to be less alone and to learn to open up my writing to others has been a huge part of the journey. And two people in particular are here, my husband David and my dear agent Abby Saul, who have played such a role in both being these great editorial masterminds and character masterminds, but beyond that, being such emotional support and believing in me in this book through so many stages of the process, and I just have to express my tremendous gratitude, and that, you know, it's such a lesson that I've taken from Maud and from this whole process, how important it is to lean on and let in other people.
And yes, clearly no one would go through this multi-year process filled with rejection and heartbreak unless they literally couldn't stop themselves.
Yeah.
So if you learn nothing else about writers, there you go.
You really learn your internal why.
You really do.
Which is not about other people, because there's no guaranteeing what anyone else will think.
No, because you're, yeah. Fame and fortune, not guaranteed. So clearly you have to have strong internal motivation. And yes, the right cheerleaders, really, really important. Just to have that voices along the way telling you, you can do it, keep going. One element also you mentioned in your acknowledgments at the end, and in a really beautiful way, I should have written the actual quote down, but you said your daughter came into the world kind of the same way as your book was coming into, you were pregnant and writing and editing at the same time, you know, a baby and now a two-year-old.
Yes, almost two.
And one of the central themes of this book really is a writer trying to decide, do I really like chase this dream of being a writer seriously, or do I want a family? Mm-hmm. And nowadays we can be told, and it is true, you can have both, absolutely. But the choice was a little more difficult in her time. And so I'm assuming you started this book before you had a child. How did becoming a mother, going through that process, did it change anything in the book, add something to it for you?
Yes, hugely. And I am somebody, it's a way in which I could so relate to Maud. And I think part of the reason that I made this struggle such a big part of the book, between kind of single-minded pursuit of a creative goal and mixing in family, motherhood, marriage, is that I had that struggle. And I really, for a long time, said that I didn't want to have children. And a big part of that was because of my creative dreams, and I didn't know if I could make them work together. And then for a while, when I was on the fence about it, I had this determination of, okay, but I'm going to get a book published before I have a baby, or I'll never do it. I know, you know, I could see just losing track of that dream, and if it doesn't happen before. And so I had this sort of rigid thinking around it. And I think it's just this amazing and beautiful irony in my life that it was several weeks after having my daughter that I got the call from Abby that the book had been, that we had a book deal. And I just remember it was, you know, I got a text from her. She's on the East Coast. It was very early morning, and I'd barely slept, and I got up to nurse, and I just was floored and flooded, and it was one of the most wonderful feelings. But I think finding that balance, it's never a perfect balance, but finding that balance for myself and kind of letting in the possibility of motherhood and the possibility of practicing and writing and all three mixed together into my life has been one of the most profound things. And I'll say that I'm so grateful I got the opportunity to edit the book again because of how long this whole process takes. A few times after that that book deal, and so I got to edit it as a mom, and I rewrote some of the key scenes with Maud and her children young several times, and I had never quite gotten them right, and I couldn't, I don't think, capture it the way I did without having experienced that myself.
You touched on this a little bit, and I want to give you a chance to answer maybe a little more fully. To me, the best historical fiction is set in the past, but offers some relevance to a modern reader, right? You don't have to write characters who sound as if they live today. That's one of my pet peeves. You know, people who are kind of like too modern for their time, you know, strikes us as, you know, not authentic. But at the same time, a story that is just solely set in the past about people doing old timey things that we can't relate to at all, does not really engage me as a reader either. So for me, the historical fiction that I write, I think of it as time travel escapism. I want to just be immersed somewhere else. And it's funny because I've purposely never written any storyline which is really about moms and kids in any depth, because I was living that life for real. So for me, writing was, one of my books was like set in the aftermath of the Titanic sinking, just because I was like, when I am in that world, I am completely immersed in it. You know, I'm not worried about the dishes. I'm not thinking, what time do I have to carpool tomorrow? Red Mistress, Russian Revolution, talk about escapism. But always, as I was, you know, in these historical worlds, the question was always, what would I have done if I had been there? And so the idea of a privileged, very spoiled young woman in Tsarist Russia, who literally loses everything, which is what happened to all the rich families, had absolutely nothing, and literally not just nothing, but they couldn't even go to the communist-run like cafeterias because they were considered what they call former people, meaning they did not exist anymore in the new communist state. So they couldn't eat. And to me, that idea of how do you handle that? What would you do if you lost everything? I wanted to know how people survived, and they did. And I found that kind of inspiring, even though I was not literally anywhere close to her situation. But it kind of made me realize people have been through horrible things and they survive. They find a way to get by. They do the best they can. They become different versions of themselves, given what they've been through. Reinvention idea. So for you, with After Anne, what about her life? What about this particular story do you think has the most resonance for like a modern reader today?
Well, I just have to say to start that you imagine into those possibilities in such a beautiful and compelling way in Red Mistress. And I really couldn't put it down at the end. And just, I was so there in Nadia's choices and decisions and the reinventions. I think, you know, there's a lot. I think the fact that Maud still keeps speaking, chirping away in my mind so much is a testament at least to how she's informed my life, and I feel like can speak to readers today. But a few key things, you know, a few that jump out, they're Maud and her husband, Ewan. Hope this isn't giving too much away, but there's bromides and barbiturates were drugs that were very widely prescribed back in the day without a lot of understanding of kind of their addictive properties and the really devastating effects that they could have in large doses. And Maud and her husband were both prescribed those drugs, and that's kind of a key piece of the latter parts of the story. And I think there's just such a hard-hitting resonance with the modern-day opioid crisis there. There's this kind of theme of male insecurity and the threat of a woman out-earning her husband. I saw this Census Bureau statistic that still today, both men and women in heterosexual marriages will overstate his income and understate her income when the woman out-earns the man, which I think just shows the persistence of that today. And it was such a key piece of this story, and it was really a key for me to unlock Ewan's character. I can say in the first drafts he was deeply unsympathetic. Readers might still find him pretty unsympathetic, but to really round him out and understand him, I had to understand how much of a threat it would have been to a man back then, how few women would have earned money, let alone out-earned their husbands, let alone outshone them in kind of every respect, and been these Maud became this celebrated public figure throughout the world, really, but in Canada in particular, she was kind of like the Mark Twain of her time and continues to be revered in that way. So, you know, it's the just kind of the deep threat to a husband, given the time and place in particular. I think that has so much to say to readers today, and a lot to be grateful for in our time, and a lot of work still to be done. And then just the, you know, that competing, I guess, the tension between single-mindedly pursuing a creative life and how to mix in other elements of life. I think that's something that so many of us can relate to today, maybe particularly women. But I think that's a part of Maud's story that I hope sticks with readers today.
And your mention of the husband, the idea that you can't judge characters in the past 100% by modern standards. Right. And even if they did some bad things, or if you want it to be a compelling read, you have to make that character understandable for who they were at the time, which you did. You know, if it was just simply, you know, bad, mean husband, then it's just, it's not as interesting, honestly, or emotionally effective, I think.
I think that's right. And that means doing the work inside to understand them yourself, right? That's how it starts.
Yes. Yeah. I had to make a extremely hardcore, sociopathic, communist,
you had a
husband. I had to look at the world through his eyes and understand why he did some things that he did. So it's a good,
did that it's take a good several process. Iterations for you too.
Yes. That's why we rewrite and rewrite. So I'm going to go, nerdy for a second, and talk a little bit about research and what goes into creating the world of the book. Historical fiction writers make things very hard on themselves because we not only have to write a full book, but then there's the second layer of making sure that all the details are right, down to really basic things like what did they eat for breakfast? Did they have a car?
What kind of toilets work? Did they have toilets? Did they have a phone? Yeah.
The most basic things. So it's like twice the work that we bring onto ourselves. And let me tell you, if you do get something wrong, guaranteed someone online will post a very long review telling you exactly what you got wrong, and it will be there forever on the internet. So we triple check everything. So just tell me a little bit about the actual research, creating her world. I know that you visited Prince Edward Island. I'm sure that was an important part of the process.
It was a very important part of the process. I did it early on in the research, and it really, first of all, it was just a childhood dream, and it gave me this sense of her world and place more than anything, where I felt like my descriptions of the nature, the beauty, the scene, you know, understanding that Avonlea and Anne of Green Gables was based on Cavendish and where it resembled, that was really, really helpful. But for me, I think that the law background really helped in the writing historical fiction in terms of doing deep research, but learning how to decide when to start writing, you know, when to stop researching, when to start writing, and to the kind of power of an outline to really ground the research, because there's endless amounts of reading to be done about and by Ellen Montgomery. And I think that having a working outline, which my law training drilled into me early on, allowed me to kind of know the bits and pieces that I was most interested in. And so then in everything I was reading, I could plug it into the parts that I wanted to tell. And I started with her journals being that kind of getting into Maud's mind, the best source for that. And then I saw it as kind of working my way out. So that was the closest to her. Went back to her fiction to kind of reimmerse in the voice. I feel like that was the best in terms of coming up with dialogue that would sound right at the time. And of course, creating Anne's voice. And then this biography, Lucy Maud Montgomery, The Gift of Wings by Mary Henley Rubio, huge resource, so well researched. That was tremendous. And, you know, because I had that working outline, then when I went to kind of secondary sources, criticism, you know, that body of work, I was able to really pick and choose and plug in the details that really mattered.
Yeah.
But I'd love to know about your process too.
Process. Yeah. I just geek out basically. I start by checking out like a stack of books from whatever the time period is from the library, ordering used copies online of books that are out of print, you know. So it's for me, again, it's like the world building comes first. And then within that world, I think what would be a good storyline set in that world, rather than starting from here's the story of what's going to happen. It's like I have to live in that world for a while. And again, usually it's sometimes terrible. But, you know, what is a path that a person could take through this world that, you know, I want to follow along.
I love that. And that there can be such different approaches to it.
Very much so.
I think is so telling. There's no one way to
do. And then I also do a lot of, maybe you do this too. So then, you know, I'll be writing the story. And again, I'm thinking specifically Red Mistress. The first part is set 1918, 1919. How would she travel from one place to another? They had cars. What kind of cars did they have in Russia? Rich people in Russia. But some people still only went in carriages. I spent like days on this question. And in my draft, I would do things like, then they went to the palace inn, and I would just have it literally in caps, figure this out later. You know, then they had dinner. find out what they ate. And I would just have these big sort of holes in my manuscript that then I would do research round two, yes, trying to find all these little details, which again, 99% of readers do not care. I could have completely made up, but I just had that voice in my head, like, I'll be called out if I don't, you know,
yes,
get the right model car.
Same. I similarly had a lot of gaps in the manuscript that I would go back and then research. And then there's the fact checking at the end. I was like a little obsessive in the copy editing beyond what a lot of writers do, but I really wanted to, particularly because I had quotes pulled from so many different sources, really go back and, yes, verify each, yes, of those. And that's its own huge process.
Yes. And then you go through the editing rounds, and thank goodness, various editors, copy editors will send back your draft going, page one, you said her hair was, you know, auburn, and page 73, suddenly it's blonde. And you're like, I had no idea because I rewrote it five times.
So it takes a team.
Other people, yes, will also point out a few things that you get wrong, which is all that's what we want.
Yes.
So you another big question I wanted to get into that you touched on is how your background as a lawyer played into historical fiction writing specifically. You mentioned it a bit. I think as someone without a law background, again, we have this. I did not make the logical connection between working as an attorney and historical fiction, but talking about the amount of writing you have to do, the attention to detail, the idea that you're used to synthesizing a whole bunch of information and you have to kind of explain it in a more understandable way. Can you talk about a little bit more about that?
The
skill set.
I went into law really with this writing bent. And so I chose litigation not because I love the fight and I love to win. I really am different than a lot of litigators, and that doesn't really drive me. I chose litigation because it's where you get to do the most storytelling and writing in the law. And I think that, you know, at first it felt like they were just in competition. You know, I was you know, trying to balance my time to kind of steal away time from law work to write and steal away time from writing to do all, you know, complete everything I needed to in my law job. And I've come to find that, you know, and I've had different kind of stages in my law career too, getting to jobs that are kind of deeper and deeper fits and are, you know, allow me kind of the autonomy and really specializing in what I love most, which is the writing part of law, but that there's ways that they're so complementary and ways that were kind of in the background all the time that I wasn't aware of as I was writing. So the, you know, the research really distilling a lot and setting those kind of daily time goals and completing tasks. There's often just, you know, you really have to be disciplined and have to be able to make a schedule to do, you know, kind of a big law job. And so that was tremendously helpful along the way. And I think I've come to realize that they're more complementary than competitive in, you know, my process now. And I'm really, really grateful for all of my time in the law and my practice in the law. And all of the people that have come into my life because of it.
Yeah, and you mentioned a schedule and organization. I think again, there's the stereotype of like the creative writer, you know, we're a little messy and the, you know, the cigarette is over here and the papers are everywhere. And
not me.
They exist and maybe they're writing experimental poetry. But if you write historical fiction, yes, you need to be creative and all that, but you have to be really organized.
Yes.
You have to keep all those details and facts straight. You have to know where to find that random quote that you remember reading 2 years ago that is suddenly relevant, and where is it in these folders of stuff? So I absolutely can see that again, it's a similar kind of, I don't know, mindset or approach where even as you're living in an imaginary world, in the real world, you have to be organized.
Yes.
Right. So did you have like a dedicated writing space with like neat folders or like how to went for like a writing space that was separate from a work space or not? Or were they kind of mixed?
The corner of my couch was my dedicated writing space.
Yeah.
I am somebody that, so as anyone who's kind of been to my house or apartment can attest, I don't like to have a lot of paper, a lot of notes. You know, the way that a lot of people organize is just not my process. I will put everything in a Word document and then it's all contained on my computer, and that makes, you know, that's just my control freak self and neat freak self. So it was really me and my computer and a big stack of books, as well as a lot of the research was online too, but, and done from, you know, kind of the comfort of my home. I've come to really honor, like, you know, a lot of writers go out and write in coffee shops. I'm somebody, I think just because I'm really sensitive to noise, I'm sensitive to that. So being at home in my most comfortable environment is my best writing place.
Yeah. I need quiet too. I'm amazed by the people who write in the loud coffee shops, because my problem is I love to eavesdrop too much.
Yeah.
Which is a writer thing also, because you're like, what's your story? Who are you? You know?
And you get lost in another world.
I can't and don't get the words on the page. If anyone in that coffee shop is talking like, I want to hear about your trip to Europe. Really? Like, how did you afford to go for a month to Europe? You look really young. Like, tell me more. true story. I got no work done. Yes. So for me, quiet, no distractions. I mean, I do write at home a lot, but the very best place for me is a library, because even at home, I'm also very guilty of like, I need a snack. That needs dusting. Things I did not care about cleaning ever suddenly become very important when I'm trying to write. You know, what's in the fridge? What's for dinner? If I'm in a library, quiet, nothing else to focus on. So that's probably my most productive place. And I live in the Chicago suburbs. I have tested out probably about a dozen libraries around me. I'm very lucky to have lots of options. So I know which ones to go to depending on my mood or the needs of that day. But yeah, the people who can kind of write amid chaos, or who, I know some people who always write with music, which again, that's great if that's part of their process. But then I would just sit there going, I should make a new playlist. I should come up with brand new songs just for this book. What song should they be? I'm going to spend a long time, you know, researching this. It's very important.
So much of it is just that the mind games that we can play with ourselves. Yes. And I think anyone who's trying to create something, there's just so many blocks that your mind will come up with, like anything to avoid getting words on the page, because it's just, it's so vulnerable and they never come out exactly like they are in your head. And just for me, it's been like, what can drown out that critical voice in my head? You know, whatever I can do to do that is
hopefully
what I
your
eliminating distractions.
Yeah, hopefully your characters start talking so loud that you can't hear the critical voice. Yeah. I think we're about to wrap up. Is there anything important that you feel we haven't addressed that you just want people to know about the book or about writing in general?
Sure. So a lot of people have asked why I write and what I hope people take from this book and my writing in particular. And I write about the creative life. I feel like that I have defined as the thing that I want to focus on. And I do that because I think that I do that in the hope that it inspires other people to create themselves. I think there's so much creative drive in each of us. And I think here, you know, reading the stories of others and what they have overcome to create what they have can be the best inspiration to kind of get over all the humps that we've been talking about today to actually do it. And from Maud's story in particular, you know, there's a lot of heart in this book. And there's a lot of huge success and brilliance and inspiration, and there's a lot of hard. And I think, you know, the why for me in telling those hard parts, I have found that through the hardest things that I've gone through in life, those have been the things from which I've learned the most. Those, you know, for better or for worse, are some of the things that stick with me and that have moved me to make really big and important changes in my life. And I think for those who love and have been moved by Ellen Montgomery's creations, to really fully understand their creator, but also I think to fully understand the creations, you need to, it's so helpful to know not only the good, but the hard in life. And I think, you know, that's just something that I hope people take and that I have taken that will always stay with me from telling this story.
Folks, I just want to thank you both for this wonderful conversation, and I want to thank all of you for coming. Let's get one more round of applause for our speakers today.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, authors Jocelyn Nicole Johnson and Rebecca Mackay discuss their work in Johnson's short story collection, My Monticello, recorded live at the American Writers Festival. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.